You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
Yes, and Chris and I covered polar bears when we were just a wee bit beginning budding podcast, podcasters in 2017. And so that was...
What can they teach us?
In 2023, the winter ice pack was at the lowest in recorded history. So just over 16 million square kilometers of pack ice going into the winter.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to All Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
Flashback to 2017. Here we go. But we're in 2024. So this is an updated episode for those that are tuned in.
Yes. And Chris and I covered polar bears when we were just a wee bit beginning budding podcast, podcasters in 2017. And so that was a lot of years ago. Right? What's my math? Seven to be exact? Six? Seven?
Yeah. Going on 7 years now. Yeah.
And so, yeah, we want to talk all about polar bears today and just relive all of their awesome behavior and their physiology. And of course, discuss their conservation message. And we're going to dive deep into that today. I know Chris has prepared a lot about climate change and the sea ice. And yeah, we're just going to check in and see how their populations are doing since we last talked, who's out there fighting for them, what we can do as people, just sitting on our sofas or scrolling on our phones, what we can do to potentially help polar bears. So they're such a fun and our iconic species, the largest land carnivore, right? And yeah, they're just in such a fun and important animal. People are drawn to them. They're a cultural symbol all over the world. So it should be a good podcast today. And this is Chris and I pleading with you not to go back and listen to episode 9.
No. We've matured so much since then. And the things we've learned over the last 6-7 years talking to conservation scientists, think about all the knowledge that we've gained and shared with everybody over the years. And so I think it gives us a more mature outlook on where polar bears are today in 2024 and what their future looks like.
Because absolutely.
It's tough.
It is. And there's such an important animal to the ecosystem. And like I said, just as a umbrella species, because they're so popular and people do adore them. My husband John got to work with them at the zoo, and so he has a lot of fun stories about how incredibly intelligent they are. It'll be a fun one. And of course, I think one thing that has not changed since 2017 is you and I love to nerd out about behavior and physiology. We've probably even turned into even bigger nerds since then, obviously. Yep. So hopefully it'll be an enjoyable podcast to listen to.
No, and the one fact, whenever we talk polar bears, and we mentioned them here and there over the years, is they're a marine mammal. They're classified as a marine mammal because they live out on the sea ice, out in the water. They're tremendous swimmers. So we're going to cover all of that today. And, you know, what is going on up in the Arctic with them. Really quick, thank you for all the support on Patreon. I just want to let you know I did send money to Monarch Watch. I did send money to the Wild. We're going to be sending money to the Polar Bear organization that Angie covers today. We're investing whatever money we earn with Patreon back into the podcast and into these organizations, giving them money, because after covering this for so many years, Angie, and there's a lot of positives. We'll talk about that today. Again, it's still an uphill fight. But remember in 2017, it's just a lot of this stuff was just emerging in the public consciousness, where today we're talking about, and I'm going to talk about it today, carbon output. You know, it's not just straws and sea turtles. It's the public consciousness today is very concerned with the climate, is very concerned with animal conservation. So I'm very hopeful for the future for polar bears and all these other animals.
Absolutely. And that was also looking at the data about the numbers. The polar bear is listed as vulnerable by the IUCN. And there are several subpopulations of them throughout the Arctic Circle that Chris and I will talk about. And some of the populations are stable. Some of them are declining. But what's definitely hopeful is that there are so many people, conservationists, scientists, locals, that really are fighting hard for these polar bears. And that was definitely a theme that emerged for me this week as I was revisiting the iconic polar bear and just to seeing how many people are fighting for this animal and therefore thinking about, talking about, working towards fighting climate change. So yeah. I just got goosebumps. So yes, it is it'll be a hopeful podcast. And so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they just, they're wonderful creatures. And
have you ever been close to one, Chris? Like,
not safely close.
The
closest I can remember ever being to one was Central Park Zoo. And the one was swimming, and he was right there up against the glass.
Yeah, so, it's always so
yeah,
cool.
Technically, I was a foot away.
Yeah.
But,
for any of the listeners out there, if you do have a local accredited zoo where they have polar bears, a lot of them have these beautiful swimming exhibits. And they'll put their paw on their glass, and the paw is like the size of a dinner plate or your like head, basically, if it's a mature adult polar bear, which is just very impressive. But I've been blessed enough to be behind the scenes, of course, with a protective barrier contact, and just really seeing them, smelled them, had them breathe on me. I was not a trainer for them. I did not work with them at the zoo. I always did the hooves and the horns, the herbivores. I'm more the herbivore gal. But to some of my keepers, fellow friends and keepers, worked with them on a day-in and day basis. And it was so remarkable just to talk to those keepers about their personalities. And then, yeah, just to see them up close like that was life-changing for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I remember at San Antonio Zoo being – on the other side of the cage wire, the grizzly bear that was drooling as she was looking at me. And I think she wanted to eat me. So, yeah. I just can only imagine me and the facts behind the scenes of the polar bear.
I don't think you taste very good.
You're
full of kiwis and Doritos anything else you had for lunch. Cheeseburgers.
No. But no, I mean, polar bears are amazing. And I know Dr. Erin Curry, you and I were talking about, I'm going to try to get her back on the podcast. One of my good friends, and she was doing a lot of great work at the Cincinnati Zoo, knowing how these bears work. Because, again, the reason Angie and I are just always so excited to promote zoos, accredited zoos, is for all the conservation work that they do. And Erin, I remember she flew up to the Arctic and is studying polar bears and their reproduction, because we need to find ways to help conserve them. So anyways, get off the soapbox. Do you need to describe this? Try to describe this?
I don't even know if I have anything in my show notes. They're very similar. You mentioned the grizzly bear, the brown bear.
Yeah.
Except that it lacks that shoulder hump that's pretty prominent in the brown bear. In general, as far as proportions go, the polar bear is the largest bear species. It's the largest
land. Is it? I've got a slide on Kodiak bears. We'll
okay.
Get there in a second.
Maybe. But yes, in general, it is bigger proportions. Maybe not the biggest of all times on average. Yeah, but the polar bear's head is relatively smaller than the head of other bears, and the neck's a little bit longer, so elongated. Other than that, I mean, they're white, and we're going to talk. The fur looks white, and but it is. It's there's more to the story than just that. So I'm gonna leave that. I'm gonna dangle that little carrot right there. But their fur can be yellowish in the summer. Almost look a little bit off color, depending on the light in the season and the conditions. But their skin is black, and so that's pretty interesting, I think. And yeah, they have a short little cute little stubby tail, and they have big feet and big padding. We'll talk a lot about their feet today for traction and how they act like snowshoes. So yeah, I mean, I think everybody's familiar with what a polar bear looks like. And I will say, though, when being 6 feet from one, 5 feet from one, with just a protective contact barrier in between us, very impressive. Very impressive. Very big. Very big. Very beautiful. So just a pretty bear. And yeah, I like the, you know, they have the cute little round ears. And like I said, the smaller head is endearing to me. I like kind of like, it's almost like a Labrador retriever or like a seal type head. It's just like, it's smaller than the big round head of like the grizzly bear.
Yeah. Well, Angie's right. It is the largest bear recognized in the world. But I always question the Kodiak Alaskan brown bears, so I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. On average, at the shoulder, a polar bear stands about 63 inches, just over 5 feet, or 1.6 meters. Yeah, that's at the shoulder.
That was the height. I remember being very impressed by the height, like, oh, snap. I mean, I'm bigger than 5 feet, but I was like, I feel like we're the same height.
Yeah,
and you're not like standing up or doing. You're just like,
no,
you know, you're on
it's
all
a small.
Fours.
Yeah, like we say, horses or cattle. It's a smaller horse or like a dairy cow, like at the shoulder. Okay, now let's talk weight. These are adult male polar bears, can weigh up to 1,800 pounds or 800 kilograms. Then when you talk about how tall, or nose to tail. On average, 9 feet tall or 100 inches. So when they stand on their hind legs like they do, they can stand almost 9 feet tall. So that's to your ceiling, polar bear. Now, the females are a little bit smaller. They weigh roughly half, but up to 2 meters in length. Now, according to the Guinness Book World of Records, the biggest polar bear ever documented was in 1960, weighed over 2,200 pounds, stood nearly 12 feet tall. Yeah, a ton. It stood
like
12
two
feet
horses.
Tall. Yes, stood 12 feet tall. So that's through your ceiling, this giant male polar bear. Now, to answer the question, is a Kodiak bear bigger? No, it's not. But they're not that far off the size of the larger polar bear. So they just are under 5 feet tall at the shoulder. The heaviest, and the average weight, 1,500 pounds or less. So your 1,700 pound polar bear, 1,500 pound Kodiak brown bear. There was a brown bear that was over 2,400 pounds at a zoo, probably feeding. they were overfeeding that brown bear. It was probably in Russia somewhere where that bear was obese. But on average, they're just
why
a
I got a bus on
bit...
Russia?
Oh, look.
I'm sorry.
I'm just thinking, you know, maybe the zoo. It wasn't San Diego Zoo. It could have been back in the day. Who knows?
I mean, most of the creatures at most zoos are pretty chunky.
Hey.
They're working on it.
On the social media, the pet bears, they're always out of Russia. Some guy driving down the street with a bear in his backseat. So it's not downtown Florida, though I wouldn't be surprised to see that in Florida these days.
Me neither.
Somebody with a big tiger in the backseat of their car.
Yeah, but that's a different podcast for a different day. And So, for sure.
So anyways, polar bears are bigger. They eke out the largest brown bear. I mean, that's the largest brown bears we can find. And those Kodiak brown bears, which we should, we did grizzly podcast, but we do a big brown bear podcast. I mean, they're eating salmon. They've got incredible diets. That's why they're able to reach the sizes that they do. Polar bears as aquatic mammals, it is the Arctic, right? They're not down here in the Antarctic, in my neck of the woods. They're all the way up there in the Great White North, in the snow, northern Canada, Greenland, parts of North Russia, Siberia, and Alaska. So those are the big parts of it. Surprisingly, they don't reach down into Norway, Sweden, or Finland. I thought they did, but maybe some might migrate down that way, but typically not part of the population. They're off the islands north mm-hmm. of Norway, but not in the mainland Europe. Since there is no sea ice connecting the Arctic and Scandinavia, polar bears don't really go down that way. There might have been a rare sighting here or there, but generally don't live in that part of the world. Now, when you break this down, it's interesting, Angie. IUCN just had a report last year, 2023, on the populations. They have the polar bears divided into 19 subpopulations into 4 ecoregions.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because the regions are impacting how we view them as conservation. Some of the regions, some of the time the bears are on land, sometimes they're on the ice. Other regions, they're all out on the ice.
Oh,
they don't
okay.
come to land. Yeah, it's interesting. It's really interesting. So one of the habitats is central and eastern Canada. So kind of in your neck of the woods, north of you in Michigan. And that goes into the Arctic. Now, during the cold winter, when there's a lot of sea ice, the bears are out on the ice. These populations that live in this region, hunting seals, digging dens, having babies, and survive out on the ice. And then in the summers, in this part of Canada, the ice retreats, which is natural, right? The mm-hmm. bears will be on land, and they really depend on their fat reserves to survive. So they get fat on seals and all those rich foods that they eat, and then they fast over the summer, maybe eat a little bit, and then the ice comes back and they go back out. Now, what's happening in the last 10, 20 years is the summer fast is getting longer and longer and longer.
Right.
Because the ice, yeah, we're having, and I talk a little bit about this, we have some really short, intense winters. The ice will freeze up, but because that ice is taking longer and longer to form and it's actually getting smaller, the bears are being deprived of food longer. So they're starving longer. And that's where you're seeing these horrible pictures on social media of very skinny polar bears.
Skinny, starving ones. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So the ice-free days for these southern bears, they call them, in Hudson Bay, is one of the things is really suffering. So these populations, their populations are trending downward. The next ecoregion, remember there's 4, so this is the second one. And this one's from Alaska over to Svalbard, or I think it's parts of Russia. And these bears, as the ice retreats, are faced with a choice. Go to land and try to survive, or stay out on the ice. And they're finding that a lot of them are staying out on the ice over the summer. The problem is the seals aren't there in the summer. So there's no food. They call it the biological productivity of the ice flows during the summer is a lot lower because the seals are going to be following the food. So they're going further south where these bears are stuck on the ice and they have nothing to eat. So they're right. also facing a long summer of starvation. The next ecoregion is these ice flows that flow in the Arctic Ocean. And there's 2 populations that just live on the Iceland, that live on the ice year round. So again, they're facing very something similar. Then there's the archipelago ecoregion. And these populations, again, live out on the ice. So you're having some of these subpopulations having to decide to live on land or stay out on the ice. But when they stay out on the ice, because there's less ice cover, they're forced into a smaller area with less bioavailability. And just to sum all that up, what that means, a lot of these polar bears are being forced into a smaller region of ice with no hunting. They're finding out that their summers are going longer and longer and longer without food. So those on land are finding ways to hunt, eat different things because they're starving. I just watched Disney's, as I was doing my slides, I told Angie, I'm watching Disney's Polar Bear. There is a sequence with the male on these really high cliffs eating bird eggs and young chicks just to keep alive. Sure, and that's no calories for that bear.
It's not historically something he used to eat. And the polar bear is known to be more of a specialist, of course, in eating seals out on the ice. And we'll talk about that when we get to nutrition. But there are studies that are showing that certain subpopulations of these polar bears are able to adapt somewhat and eat other foods that they traditionally historically didn't eat. So, which is helpful because, okay, they're smart and they know how to get other food, but it's also bringing them more closer to humans. And as Chris mentioned, not enough nutrient dense food that they're going after. So yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. It is tough. And you know, it's getting into why polar bears matter. I mean, I don't need to hammer home the climate change. I know Angie's itching to go just to set her up. But 2023 was the hottest year on record. 2024, as we record this, is predicted to be even hotter. There is a bunch of abnormal weather across the globe. In episode 343, Gray Whales, Angie and I talk about this, about how that sea ice retreating is causing them to starve. It's impacting them. In 2023, the winter ice pack was at the lowest in recorded history. So just over 16 million square kilometers of pack ice going into the winter, where historically that can be upwards of 18 to 20 million square kilometers. So we know the Arctic ice pack is melting. And one day they're predicting in the future, the way trends are, there will be no pack ice up there. Yeah. So that's a big concern for everybody and polar bears.
Absolutely. I mean, and you hit the nail on the head with polar bears. Why care? There's several reasons. But one of the most important ones is that polar bears and their health, how they look if they're skinny and if they're unhealthy and are eating different things they wouldn't normally be eating, is because they're an indicator of how healthy the ecosystem is. So polar bears are this ambassador for what's happening in the Arctic right now. They serve to help us gauge and measure the effects of climate change in real time. So what's happening to these different subpopulations, as Chris mentioned, especially the ones that are used to being out on the ice more, and they're losing that pack ice and changing how they behave and dying off, that's a huge canary in the coal mine, or indicator, if you will, of broader environmental changes happening worldwide. To us humans, right? Like polar bears don't survive, we don't survive, that whole kind of thing. And so it's, you know, and as it stands, all 99 point something of all the existing climate models predict that, yeah, I mean, the Arctic summers are going to be ice free by 2100 unless things change, if not sooner. Yeah. So because of that, they do serve as this really like eye opener. But then from a just a ecosystem role of where exactly they live, polar bears are very important in the food web. They're considered a keystone species, which means being a top apex predator in the ecosystem. They're really important to help balance organisms below them. And so because of that, there's several species underneath them that are connected to the polar bear's food web. For instance, one of their primary foods that they eat are seals. But the polar bears don't eat all of the seals. They leave a lot of the carcasses and things like that, which are very important for Arctic foxes. And so if Arctic foxes don't have the leftovers of the polar bear food, they die off. And when they die off, there'll be too many Arctic hares, because that's what an Arctic fox eats as well. So, and if there's too many Arctic hares, that throws off like the seed dispersal and all sorts of things that go on, especially in the summertime months in the Arctic. So really, really important as a keystone species as well. And in helping basically regulate predator-prey populations, being this keystone species. And the other thing too is polar bears help nutrient cycling. So through their hunting and feeding behaviors, polar bears can contribute to this nutrient cycling of the Arctic ecosystem. And that in turn helps even like the smallest microbes within the Arctic and the tundra survive as well. And they depend on it. And another really big one is when it's not about the money, it's about the money, right? So ecotourism plays a huge role in several cities. For example, in Churchill, Manitoba, in Canada, it's estimated over $7 million a year just in people coming and spending their money to watch the polar bears be polar bears. I have yet to do that. It's definitely on my bucket list. I'm not sure about you, Chris, but I would love to get in one of those Arctic buggies and just watch polar bears be polar bears while I'm like warm in an Arctic buggy.
Dream job.
I know, right? One of those safaris can cost up to $20,000, which is why I haven't gone yet. But yeah, so I mean, it's no joke the amount of dollars that these polar bears can generate just from wildlife viewing, and not only in Canada but in other cities throughout the Arctic region where they're found, and that money is really beneficial to those regions that are not necessarily known for their tourism for other reasons, right? Mm-hmm. So this live bear viewing is just, it's a really, really growing trend, and people are wanting to see polar bears more and more. So I couldn't find exactly an estimate of how much a polar bear's life is worth. There's a really cool news article going around about researchers estimating that each baleen whale that's alive and swimming in the ocean has about a $2 million net worth as far as actually carbon credits and nutrient cycling and just all these cool things that they add to the environment and putting it to a dollar amount. I couldn't find anything that like similar to that for polar bears, but just that from an ecotourism point of view, they definitely generate a lot of income locally to these different regions.
Well, it's good you bring that up, because I do want to talk about carbon and our impact on travel. But let's take a quick break. When I get back, I just got back from Australia. If you've been following us on social media, I felt a little guilty about it. And I'll tell you why.
Because you didn't bring me?
That. But yeah, I do feel guilty that you weren't there with when I did the behind the scenes with the...
Thank you. Yeah, with the wombat. I was sad about that too.
The wombat. I saw the wombat on a leash, and then I also got to feed a bitarang. But no, this is more about my travel and my impact. So we get back at the break. I'm going to talk about that and what I'm doing about it. And then we'll do a quick evolution, because we've covered bears and polar bears before, and then highlight some of the cool things about these animals. So we'll be right back.
And Chris will answer the question, do bitarangs really smell like popcorn?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake, and if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mischief Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Okay, welcome back. Angie asked me, do binturongs smell like popcorn? Yes, they do. They actually do. So you can go to our social media, All Creatures Podcast, Instagram. There's a video of me feeding a binturong. They are so amazing. We covered them way so many episodes ago. It's all highlighted there in socials. But yeah, that was fun. Now, what got me thinking about it was last year we interviewed Bob Poole, Secrets of Elephants, filmographer that was released a year ago. Wonderful hour spent with him, Angie and I, talking to him. And at the end, he was talking about, he's asking people to go to Africa, that ecotourism is keeping these animals alive. And he said, I understand the carbon impacts, but if you don't travel and you don't go to these places and see these animals, they're going to go away. So I debated and I was like, okay. And I had a good discussion with you the other day about it. You know, how do we offset our travel? And you went into a very good discussion about, Chris, think about it. Before we started this podcast, we wouldn't even talk about carbon credits, carbon offset. It wasn't even in our consciousness, right?
No, I mean, it wasn't. It wasn't something that we really, yeah, we just flew on airplanes and we didn't think about it. It wasn't in the conversation. Or maybe it was in the conversation for other people, what other people can do, or even with electric cars and stuff like that, that it wasn't something we could bring into the conversation. But now, I mean, people are at least thinking about it, talking about it. There are ways to potentially offset some travel or to do it theoretically more green or better at it. It's definitely hopeful because it is important. I just mentioned going to see the polar bears, right, in Churchill, Manitoba. But yes, for me right now, where I'm at in Florida, that would be a plane flight for sure. Now, I don't have my own jet. Surprise, surprise. So I would be flying coach. And have my toddler on my lap, basically. But still, how could we do that better? And I think just even having those conversations, and not only are we having these conversations because we are conservationists and are wanting the planet to be healthier for us and for wildlife and all that, but big businesses are having these conversations, right? Like they're talking about trying to figure out how to make a plane that doesn't emit anything when it travels from point A to point B and how they can do that. And so there are these conversations being had by people like us, by big business. Here in the U.S., not as much as by politicians as I wish it was. I hope to see that more of that. But what we can do and what I know Chris and I are doing and probably a lot of you listening to this podcast is we can vote with our dollar and we can try to show the companies that run the world and you know, have all the money and stuff of what we – you know, what kind of products we want, how we want, who we want to buy from, and mm-hmm. how we want their companies to be. And so, yeah, it is a hopeful time in that these conversations are being had and that we can actually actively do stuff and be more conscious about it and be more aware of, like, if I do fly in a plane, this is, you know, how much carbon I'm emitting. And so, you can be more aware of these things and probably, as you've realized, Chris, after your wonderful trip to Australia that I didn't get to go on, but yeah, that you and Pip are going to plant some trees.
Well, yeah, let me explain what I did. So I did look up how do I be a responsible traveler in 2024. And one thing that popped up that everybody can do, and I never saw this before, and I thought, wow, this is brilliant. Yes, I'm going to do this, is when you're in a hotel room or wherever you're at, put up your do not disturb sign. Hotels want to give you the best experience possible. And the maids come in, they clean your room, they vacuum, change your towels every day, change your sheets, whatever. You put up your do not disturb sign every now and then. They won't come in and that reduces use of power. But what I was really thinking, because I flew to Australia and went on the trip, how do I offset that carbon? And I read an interesting article that was put out by Nat Geo last year, and it's, should you buy carbon offsets for your air travel? And it said, you know, more than a third of Americans would pay extra to offset their carbon. So you're starting to see that when you search for tickets. You know, you can offset some airlines, which there was debate in that article, like, should they put it on the consumer? Why aren't the companies?
Right, yes.
Right, yeah, okay. Yeah. So I get that. But the article was interesting in the sense, yes, it's a bit murky right now, but like you said, we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. And there are programs out there that you can donate money to help offset carbon. For example, you could pay $8.50 to a program in Honduras that replaces open fire cooking pits with custom built brick and mortar stoves that require less wood to cook meals. And you're not only helping the Honduras peoples, you're also reducing carbon. So you're helping by donating money. So I did some digging. I was like, oh, do I buy carbon credits? But then that's a whole nebulous thing. I did calculate our flights to Brisbane for Pip and I. It was roughly 1.3 tons of carbon. That's only a 3-hour round trip. I know. It's like, and I don't know, you know, it's like 300 kilograms of carbon times two people, which equals 600. We doubled it. That is 1,200 kilograms, roughly 1.3 tons of carbon in the flight. It's usually per flight, it's 90 kilograms of carbon per passenger per hour. That's where I got that data. So I looked around and I was like, I could buy a carbon credit, which is 70 New Zealand dollars, which is probably like $5 American because American dollars are strong. But I did find one that it seems pretty credible and I want to do a little bit more digging. But sustainabletravel.org is a nonprofit organization that for about $30 American, I can offset the carbon. And what they're doing is you're purchasing offsets for your travel and they're investing the monies they raise into different projects. So they have a big part climate impact portfolio and the money's being diversified. It's not all into one project. It's into multiple projects that cover forests. So they're restoring and improving sustainable management of forest ecosystems, safeguarding ecosystems, working on carbon sequestration. So that is a big project I'm working on. And one of the ones, they have a multiple in their projects, is the Massa Red Plus project, Brazilian Amazon. So they're going in and improving standing forests and planting more trees. Okay, that's one of many under forests. Then their energy, projects decreasing energy or carbon pollution. So renewal projects that they're working on. They're funding innovative tech. So MIT, a lot of these major think tanks in the world are developing carbon sequestration tools and things we can use. Then they have another one that's in development, Blue and Teal Carbon. That's working on coastal and freshwater ecosystems. So I'm going to send them money to offset my carbon for my travel. I'm going to start building that into my travel budget. So when Pip and I say, hey, we're going to go travel, we're going to go, okay, I'm going to calculate our carbon output. And that's part of our budget. So we need to save up for it. And that's how I'm going to be a responsible traveler in 2024.
Well, I love that, Kristen. Let's make sure and put that link of calculating your carbon travel numbers on our website, so on our show notes, so that people can have access to it and we'll put it on social media as well. Because I think that is a very, very helpful. Just to, and even if you don't do anything about it, just to be aware and be thoughtful of what's going on, and maybe other ways. Maybe you don't have money to donate to buy offset credits or anything like that, but maybe there's other things that you can do. So I think that's a great way to approach 2024. Still travel. I know you're a big wildlife viewer when you go, obviously. You mentioned wombats and bitterns, and of course, all the birds you saw. Oh my goodness.
Yep.
Was it the red-footed booby?
Yeah, saw that off the coast. Yep.
Incredible. Yep. So, I mean, that's, yeah, I think that, I mean, yeah, you want to keep doing that, but the ways that you can do it better. So, yeah, no, that's really inspiring. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love going to Australia. I just love it. And it's in my backyard. So, I mean, I obviously travel around New Zealand, but then I get to jump on an airplane. So, not to rub it in, but it is climate change is the polar bear's number one threat right now. It's massive to them. And when you're talking about a bear species that has been around for a million years, 600,000 years, you know, I want to do everything I can to help protect them. So that jumps into their evolution. Remember that the family, I mean, they're carnivore, they're mammal. Ursidae is the family. The two oddballs are the panda and speckled bear.
Ooh, we haven't done the speckled bear yet. That's a good beer.
Yeah, the spectacled bear. Yeah, we're going to do that one soon. And then the Ursinae is the other six species. So the polar, brown, sun bears, Asiatic black bear, sloth bear, and American black bear. Species name, Ursus maritimus. So remember, maritime. This is an aquatic bear, aquatic mammal, marine mammal. Bears emerged about 30 million years ago. Again, you have the three subfamilies, the giant panda, then the speckled bear, and then the real bears, the Ursinae. The closest relative to polar bears is brown bears. There is still some debate on this, you know, when they diverged. What we do know is brown bears and polar bears are very closely related. We are, and I hesitate to say this, but we are in an ice age right now. This ice age has been going around for 2.5 million years. We're in a warming trend. They are natural. They do happen naturally. What we're seeing today is not natural because it's happening so rapidly.
Right. I think that's a big yeah. point to make clear. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to talk about this without people going, oh, it's natural. Let it happen. No, because the bears don't have time to adjust. When there was this ice age 2.5 million years ago, the brown bear and polar bear, ancient relative, some started to eke out this niche in these polar regions, in these cold regions, to become polar bears. And then the other ones were on the edges that became the brown bears or grizzlies. If climate change happens too rapidly, polar bears don't have time to adjust. And they're going to go extinct. And we're going to lose multiple species. And it's not just polar bears. It's the plants. It's all the other native wildlife. There just isn't time these thousands of years that these warming trends usually happen. So that's why it's a little difficult to talk about that. Polar bears are critically important to the ecosystems. They are a species we need to fight for. And they are that umbrella species for the Arctic. So that's why you see them with World Wildlife Fund. In the last 10 years, we've always been talking about polar bears because they are one of those species that we look at and we can see, like the monarch butterfly and some of these other big ones, suffering, right?
Real time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, we're off our soapbox. That was the quick evolution. You can always go back to other bear episodes if you want to listen more in depth about that. Polar bears, like other large carnivores, they can live into their 20s. Most don't live past 20. Under human care, one did live to be 45.
So right, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty old, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And again, under human care, optimal conditions. They have their own personal doctors. They're being fed perfectly. But out in the wild, it's tough. It's really tough for them. Some other stats. No, you can't outrun a polar bear. I think most people know that. 40 kilometers per hour or 25 miles per hour. And you can't outswim them. Oh, God, I would dive. Chased by a polar bear in the water. They swim up to 4 miles per hour, 6 kilometers per hour. So they are quick. But I'm just going to throw it in here. I have the slide a little bit later. Very rare for polar bears to attack people. I know I see it on social media or websites. Oh, you know, what would you do if you ran into a polar bear? Unfortunately, last year there were a couple people killed in Alaska. It was an old starving male that attacked them. He was killed, but it had been 30 years since anybody was attacked by a polar bear in Alaska, and it's rare. There was a study, the Wildlife Society Bulletin. There were 73 polar bear attacks between 1870 and 2014. So less than one a year, and it's usually nutritionally stressed males that are starving, that are looking for anything to eat. It's really rare. So yeah, they can chase you down, but it's not.
Just stay in the ice buggy.
Yes, stay in the ice buggy. There you go. Now, the other thing I remember, Angie, it was like yesterday in my old house in Florida, you talking and blowing my mind away about their hair. Now, we know their skin's jet black,
mm-hmm.
which is
crazy.
And
their nose. I love their noses.
And their noses. But their hair is not white.
Yeah, crazy. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is that we're going to go through, I'll run off a whole list of incredible adaptations that polar bears have to live in this Arctic climate and do what they do. And they have mastered it over a millennia or more of evolution. And one of the things is that they are white in color to look at because, well, of course, they camouflage in with the ice and the snow. But interestingly enough, the fur is not technically white. So polar bears have this dense fur, right, that keeps them warm. It's very insulating fur coat, and it has two layers. The outer layer consists of this like long guard hair that looks white and repels water, but it's not white. It's actually translucent. And these translucent guard hairs help the bear blend into its icy surroundings by actually reflecting and diffusing the sunlight. So it's really colorless hair that appears white, well, because they are usually on the snow and the ice in the Arctic environment. And then this camouflage, of course, is essential for them hunting seals when they're hanging out on the ice waiting to ambush them or attack them or whatever. And then, of course, there's a second layer of hair that is shorter and provides insulation to really keep in that body heat and keep them warm. So yeah, really, polar bears aren't technically white. Their hair, they just look like they're white. It's more translucent. And then seasonally, depending on how well kept they are and the time of year, they can look more yellow in color, probably when the snow's not as white itself. So yeah, pretty incredible. And that's just one of their many adaptations that they have.
Their superpowers, yeah.
Yeah, one of their superpowers. Mm-hmm. And then just to list several others is they have a thick layer of blubber that serves as insulation against the cold. The other thing that's fascinating is I do love their small ears and their little stubby tail, but that's actually to help reduce heat loss as well. These compact features help minimize exposure, body part exposures to the cold. And of course, they also have specialized feet. But before I dive into their feet, I want to just mention that they have countercurrent heat exchange, which is that specialized circulatory system where it prevents heat loss by basically warming the blood as it moves from the inner body down towards like the feet and the other extremities. And then also when the cold blood comes back up or the blood that's been cold by being near the snow, that it gets warmed up as it moves into the body's cavity. But that helps them conserve heat and not lose heat to their feet. And then as I mentioned about polar bear feet is they are huge. They help distribute the weight. If you can think of like a snowshoe mentality, right? When a bear is hunting and traveling and looking for food, especially as it becomes more sparse with climate change, one statistic said that they could travel close to 5,000 miles in one season over the ice looking for food. And so having these big feet that act like snowshoes help them distribute weight as they cross over the snow and also gives them traction. And there's foot pads on the bottom. And if, like anybody who's ever had a polar bear put their paw up to the glass when they're swimming around like at a zoo, you can see these foot pads. And they're beautiful, and they're covered with dozens of little small papillae that act to help increase the surface area of the foot pad and add as friction to help them from not slipping on the ice the way that we do, or at least the way that I do when I'm walking on the ice. And then, of course, the feet are super furry with all the fur in between the toes, and that's going to act to help conserve heat. So yeah, their feet are just incredible. And like I said, being up close to them is very, very impressive and and humbling at the same time. That's for sure. And then of course, there's being a species of bear, there's several adaptations when it comes to reducing their metabolic rate during periods of fasting, like Chris was talking about, or during periods of like low food. Polar bears don't go into a traditional type of hibernation, when we think about like the brown bear or the grizzly bear, but they do something called a walking hibernation, and this is a state that allows them to lower their metabolic rate and conserve energy, but not a true hibernation. And during this time, the polar bear will have, of course, reduced food intake, also reduced water intake, and they have specialized kidneys that can efficiently concentrate the urine, which helps them conserve water during these walking hibernations or low food and low water state. And during this time, they'll have limited activity where they are usually in their den and they're trying to maintain their body temperature. But while at the same time, not lose muscle mass, because they eventually will need to get out there and get hunting and finding food. And so, because it's not a true hibernation, it's called walking hibernation with the polar bears, they have the ability to wake quickly. So when they do decide to increase their activity state to go hunting, or maybe they smell some food or something, they can quickly respond to their environment and get up and get out and get moving. So it's very, very flexible physiology, which is super fascinating. And when we think about a polar bear, once again, from this evolutionary point of view of how they're able to live in such harsh climates and be so successful. They are the largest land carnivore. Mm-hmm. Like, they're good at it. This is, you know, the walking hibernation is just another adaptation that they have to be able to survive.
Well, one of the things you're talking about, how well they survive the cold, right? So they have thick layer of blubber, which they depend on in the summer to keep nutrients going. This fur, these guard hairs, they're meant to survive in extreme cold or colder temperatures. So if I asked you what you think the temperature high was for the far north of Canada last summer, what do you think it peaked at?
Well, I'm going to probably be better at guessing at it than you, since I live... thrived and survived. Yeah. Survived and not only survived, but thrived working outdoors in Chicagoland area. Shout out to all my zookeepers there at Brookfield Lincoln Park Zoo. You would get alerts like, don't go outside.
it
feels like minus 20. And we're like layering, you know, putting on our layers of polar fleece and all the stuff. And we're going out there and we're doing it. Therefore, I don't know, the average temperature, what was the question, in the wintertime?
In the summer.
Average temperature in the wintertime or the summertime?
Let's go summer. Okay. No, you're good. Okay.
I was
Chicago,
ready for the winter. I was like,
minus
for the winter.
20 polar bears are loving it.
A party.
Yeah, I'm a leopard seal, if I'm ever coming back as an animal, in the Antarctic. Just got to dodge killer whales every now and then. Living in that weather, I'm built for it. It's like a nice little cool pool for me. In the summer, far north, North Canada, Northwest Territory.
Yeah, I don't know, like up there, 32 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's not a high. That's an average spring day. So the whole point of this is, last year, this is going to blow you away, Edgy. Last year, again, hottest year on record, Fort Good Hope in the Northwest Territories of the far, far north recorded a day near 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 38 degrees Celsius.
What?
In the heat of summer, 100 degrees. That is Florida. When I was there, 90s in the summer was average. Florida, yeah. Tropical.
Yeah.
100 degrees.
I mean, for my answer, my guess was like 32 or like I was thinking maybe 40 on a really hot day.
And a polar bear Yowzers. That's on land, not out on ice, is suffering with that heat. And I remember that because you triggered me to remember we talked about moose. Moose don't sweat. When it gets above 85 degrees Fahrenheit, moose start dying.
Right.
Because they can't cool down.
Yeah.
They don't have the ability to dissipate that heat. You're talking about how these polar bears loving it in the cold, minus
thriving.
20, whatever.
Yeah.
100 degrees Fahrenheit?
No, like, that's not good.
Yeah, okay.
Wow, sorry, I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
Okay, but now I want to, how cold does it get? Can I guess that average that?
I got to research that real quick. Yeah.
Colder than Chicago, let's just say that.
Sure. Canada. I don't know. I don't need to look it up. You're probably looking at minus 50. I mean, it's cold.
Yeah, I don't
know.
It's
cold, yeah. And it can get too cold for them.
Our Arctic friends can chime in.
Yeah. I mean, imagine the polar bears that are starving. They don't have – they go into winter without that blubber layer and if they don't have it and a big cold front comes through, they're in trouble. Because when you talk about them eating, hunting, two of their main prey are ring seals, bearded seals. Less than 2% of their hunts are successful.
Right.
So
that's a lot of energy wasted.
Yeah. Now, fact I always love about bears is they have the best sense of smell than any animal on earth or mammal that we know of. We would say a bloodhound is probably the best dog, tracking dog, right? Which is about 300 times better than our sense of smell. So your poor bloodhound in your house, you know, could smell anybody. My dogs can smell me from a mile away. But a bear's ability to smell or their olfactory ability is 7 times better than a bloodhound's. We talk about polar bears out on the ice hunting, very good eyesight, but they can also smell a seal from almost like a mile away.
It's incredible.
Then they're able to guide, their nose guides them in. So whenever you watch the movies or videos of them, their nose is always up in the air. They're always smelling, mm-hmm. smelling, looking for prey. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But like talk about these seals have so much blubber and fat, these energy-rich diets that the polar bears eat, allows them to be bigger and then build up that layer of blubber, right? That protects them during the winter. Now, one of the things you always see in these documentaries is polar bears hunting walrus, other species. It's occasional. Now, that might be happening a little bit more because, like we said, out on the ice, less ice. We know walruses are being forced up on beaches rather than ice floes. So that might be more opportunities for them, but, you know, it's still tough for polar bears to hunt them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they do scavenge on carcasses and washed up whales and other things and carry on, but seals are their bread and butter.
Absolutely. And I think it's really fascinating. Polar bears have two hunting styles. So number one is like the lie in wait. So it's called still hunting. And this is one they actually use the most, probably because it does conserve energy, I'm just guessing. But this basically involves finding a seal's breathing hole in the ice, probably through their good sense of smell, as Chris mentioned, and waiting for the seal to surface again and then just make the kill. So pretty fascinating. The other one is stalking, which is going to be more energy dense, taking more energy from them. But this technique, the polar bear will stay crouched and out of sight using that translucent fur to blend in and creep up on the seal. Another way that they'll stalk seal hunting is to swim through channels or cracks in the ice until they're close enough to catch the seal. So very, very incredible hunters, intelligent. And as Chris mentioned, using that superpower smell is definitely very, very helpful for them to do this. But in each one of these cases, I've mentioned them hunting on ice, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So needing the ice to do what they do to find their food. And so when we talk about why climate change is just is impacting these polar bears, I mean, when you reduce the ice cover, that just reduces the amount of hunting area that they had significantly. And that's what they've evolved to do and how they've evolved to hunt. And it reducing the sea ice also shortens their hunting seasons, increases their energy expenditure per hunt, and also makes them swim longer distances. I mean, there's some just like crazy statistics out there about how far, I mean, bears are phenomenal swimmers, as Chris mentioned.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, polar bears just can, yeah, they were built to swim and they can hunt, you know, they can swim and hunt in the water. But in the same instance, they have to have the ice to land on at some point in time. And for anybody who's ever spent any time in the water swimming, it's very exhausting. And that's no different if you're, you know, a human or a polar bear. So they can do it, but it's also expends a lot of energy. And so you're increasing more time that they're swimming, less time that they're on the ice. And then, of course, too, as this ice is leaving, you're going to increase human bear conflicts. And it's going to also really threaten the cubs that are coming up each spring, as far as making it more challenging for them to survive if it's hard for the female to survive.
And I love watching the documentaries on them and showing them how sneaky they are and their critical thinking, you know, seeing a seal and then diving under the ice and popping up. Yeah, they're just, that's why we love them. And they're just,
well, yeah. Very, very and any incredible. Of my zookeeper friends that have worked with them or with John will always tell stories about just how intelligent they are, how fun they are to train, of course, through protected contact, but also how hard they are to enrich, because you have to give them like really good puzzles and make it really interesting and lots of toys and different food enrichment and stuff to keep them stimulated. Because when you look at a polar bear's activity budget in the wild, they do spend a solid 66.6% of the time sleeping or lying or waiting or still hunting, which seems like a fair amount. But when you compare it to the rest of the time, they spent traveling, walking, swimming. That's about 29.1% of the time, very busy, expending a lot of energy hunting or moving, looking for food, swimming, walking. They spend about 1.2% time stalking prey and about a total of 2.3% of the time actually feeding. So, and this is a little bit dated as far as this activity budget, time budget. So it would be interesting now with some of the different subpopulations having a reduced sea ice to see if that changes. Are they spending more time walking, less time resting and sleeping, that kind of thing, which once again will decrease their overall body condition. And when it comes to social behavior in general, polar bears are solitary, of course, except for when there's a mother caring for her cubs. And then when a male is interested in a female for breeding, and I'll talk about that here in a second. Cubs are very playful. We've all seen the documentaries where they're just two little furry white snowballs rolling around and just they'd love to run and chase and play and just which is all really good. Play is, of course, a great way to practice for hunting and other social to practice for hunting and other skills needed later on in life. And of course, polar bears are active communicators. They communicate through body language, mostly, of course, with one another during the breeding season or if they come across each other. As far as their posture goes, their posture can display dominance, submission, or aggression. They can stand on their hind legs, as Chris mentioned, and be 9 feet tall and display dominance, or they can, you know, kind of crouch down for submission. And then, of course, polar bears are going to use a lot of scent to communicate pheromones. They use urine to mark to communicate their presence in an area and also their reproductive status. They will scrape and roll in different scents on the ground and or they're probably spreading some of their own scents as well. And with that great sniffer that they have, that cute little black, perfectly black sniffer, the polar bears can detect scents over long distances, right? And they can use this keen sense of smell to find mates, food sources, and let other bears know, hey, this is my territory. And then lastly, polar bears communicate through several vocalizations. And this is something, too, my husband was so blessed when he worked with them that he was very privy to all the different vocalizations that include chuffing. And that's often, that's more maybe a maternal, when a mother bear is worried about her her cub's safety. There's scolding, a large growl or soft chuff. I do that a lot to my children.
Me too.
There's hissing and snorting. A lot of times that's aggression. There's, of course, loud roars or growls. These are going to communicate anger. There's deep growls, which might be a warning or defensive for food. There is something called rushing, and that's when a male approaches a female with cubs. And then there's tons of non-vocal communications, which once again have to do more with social affiliation, where they go nose to nose and greet each other, or they might beg for food like a cub to a mom. And then, of course, there's going to be a lot more of this communication that we will see during polar bear breeding season. And so in the Arctic, polar bears are typically going to mate in late winter and early spring from March to June. And during breeding season for courtship displays, the male polar bear will engage in several different displays to attract females, which of course will include some of those vocalizations I was talking about, posturing and other behaviors to show that he's ready to mate. And of course, the female polar bear will only be receptive to the male when she is in estrus and under the influence of high estrogen. And once male and female polar bear do come together and breed, a female polar bear's pregnancy, her gestation, can last anywhere from 195 to about 265 days. And the reason for this wide, wide range is that depending on the health of the female, the nutrients available, pregnant polar bear females can experience what's called embryonic diapause, otherwise known as delayed implantation. Chris and I have talked about that a lot before in other species where the egg is fertilized by the sperm and starts to divide and grow into a multicellular blastocyst. And somewhere along that embryonic development, the blastocyst phase, it stops growing. It's like I call it suspended animation. And it just lies floating around in the uterus for up to 4 months. And then through hormonal signaling or nutritional signals, researchers don't really know, the blastocyst then decides to just stop being in suspended animation and just now attach to the uterus and start developing as a normal embryo or embryos, right? Because a female can give birth to 1 to 3 cubs. So yeah, it's super fascinating. And this process allows a female, if she's not, if she doesn't have enough fat storage or a good nutrients on board, it allows more time for her to store more fat, prep for the winter, and then hopefully get this thick layer of blubber in order to survive, to take care of herself and a growing fetus, or 1 or 2 or 3, depending on how many cubs she has. And so it potentially gives her more time to do that. So it's fascinating. Delayed implantation could be a whole podcast on its own. And I still think we'd probably have more questions and answers after the podcast. And Chris and I being reproduction, that was our specialty at the university in Florida. Love this topic. So I won't go too much into the weeds today, but just know that they do this. And I think it's another superpower that they have from an evolutionary point of view, to basically be able to provide enough nutrients in these crazy harsh climates. It's just it's incredible physiology. And so when the cubs are born, the mother gives birth to them in a den that she's built, typically between November and January. And once again, it's from 1 to 4, typically 1 to 3 cubs. The polar bear cubs are born with their eyes closed. They do have a fair amount of fur, thank goodness, right? It's cold out. And they weigh about 600 grams. So they're itty bitty compared to mama polar bear that's over 1,000 pounds. And so they just hang out, developing further, and they will emerge from their den in the spring when they're about 10 to 15 kilograms. So a pretty large amount of weight that they put on. The mama polar bear will remain in her walking hibernation state in the den with the cubs, nursing them until the spring, until about April. Now, due to the harsh conditions and once again, and the incredible demand that nursing 1 to 3 or 4 cubs can have on a polar bear, the mortality rate for cubs is about 10 to 30%. Don't even survive, springtime to actually leave the den. That doesn't include like predation and starving later on or anything like that. So it's very tough. And the mother polar bear will provide all the parental care of her cubs. And the cubs will stay with her for about 2 to 3 years, learning how to be a polar bear and how to do these different hunting styles and where the sea ice is and where the seals are and when, you know, what time of year we head west or we head north or we head south. And so there's a lot of maternal investment put into these cubs. And so therefore she's not going to breed every year. And the other thing about their generation interval is it's not super fast. A typical male and female polar bear will not reach sexual maturity in order to start breeding until they're about 5 or 6 years old. So it's a slow turnover rate. And I think that's why when we look at numbers, I mean, polar bears, of course, were almost completely wiped out because of overhunting and all that back in the earlier mid 20th century. And it was just crazy. For example, in Alaska in 1984, polar bear populations were estimated to be under 2,000. And so anyways, early in the 21st century, most places designated the polar bears a protected species. And, you know, currently there's estimated to be somewhere between 22,000 and 31,000. There's a lot of protections put in place and people have their eyes on them. They are this keystone and ambassador species. So people are paying attention and conserving them and not hunting them anymore, thank goodness. But as you can see, it's not like their numbers just like bounced right back. A lot of it's because of their reproductive biology, but then also, you know, now because of all these current threats with climate change.
Well, yeah. So if you take the average IUCN, they're vulnerable 26,000 roughly. And that's spread over 5,000 square kilometers. I mean, massive. That's just the Arctic Ocean. I mean, it's more than that. There isn't a lot of polar bears in the world. That is a small, you know, basketball stadium or arena, you know, whatever sport you like to watch. That's their total population. 20,000 something. That is nothing over that wide, vast area and being a top predator. So it is a big concern when you look at the IUCN data and you look at the individual populations. The ones in the Arctic, like right at the on the ice, we don't have good populations. But the ones in Canada, so just a few minutes ago, I was telling Angie, you know, 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the Northwest Territory, those populations of polar bears are decreasing. We know that. And it's probably because of temperature and things that are driving them to extinction. Other places like off Alaska over to Siberia, you know, that part of the world, Barents Sea, those populations are stable. So it is a big concern with them, Angie. And, you know, like I said, conservation tip, look at how to offset your carbon when you travel, build it into your budgets. these are awesome animals, and we know there's many organizations with the focus on them, but who did you want to talk about today?
Well, Chris, we might have matured since 2017 as far as how we do our podcast, but I want to talk about the same organization I mentioned several years ago, and that is Polar Bear International. And so they can be found at www.polarbearsinternational.org, and they are an incredible group that are dedicated strictly to polar bear conservation. That's all they do, and they do it very well. They understand polar bears, their habitats, their ecology, and of course, most importantly, the threats. And they're considered an important leader in the conservation efforts of polar bear. And so they have several strategic approaches and to do this that include education, which of course that's what Chris and I love to talk about and what we do on a weekly basis. But Polar Bear International also conducts, supports, and shares scientific research. They work together with several other organizations, NGOs, and governments, and things like this to basically help manage polar bear populations and help businesses provide sound policies and practices towards polar bears. And I know Chris and I will put all this up on our show notes as well, because I just strongly believe that they're a fantastic group that really, really knows what they're doing.
Yeah, well, there's your update on polar bears, where they are. And in another 6-7 years, we'll come back to them. But, you know, it's good to look back at some of the species we've covered. And
yeah, and I think in the meantime, too, it'd be great to get some of those researchers or conservationists that are out there in the polar buggies seeing really what's happening in real time.
Yeah. See how they're reacting and how things, you know, because climate change isn't going anywhere. It's not going to be solved in the next 5, 10. It's going to take 20, 30 years. So best advice, stay positive. There's a lot of good stuff going on around the world. Conservation is in everybody's minds. And, you know, we're going to keep following the story. And we've got a lot of good species coming up, a lot of new ones. And it's going to be an incredible year. So stay tuned and thanks for listening.
Thank you, everyone.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.